from WBUR Boston. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a long, hard battle in Wisconsin. Unions hanging by a thread, a governor up for recall, a near civil war of partisanship. But 16 months after the firestorm erupted, the votes are in, and so is Republican Governor Scott Walker, at least until the end of his term.
Tonight, we tell Wisconsin, we tell our country, and we tell people all across the globe that voters really do want leaders who stand up and make the tough decisions.
13 points ahead, Walker held his seat firmly. But are things really just the same for Wisconsin, for the nation? This hour on Point, Wisconsin's recall vote fallout. You can join the conversation. Wisconsinites, how are you feeling? What do you make of the result? Scott Walker succeeds. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We just heard from Governor Walker. Let's hear from his challenger, Democratic Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, who conceded the recall election, saying Wisconsinites need to listen to each other.
The state remains divided, and it is my hope that while we have lively debates, a lively discourse which is healthy in any democracy, that those who are victorious tonight, as well as those of us who are not victorious tonight, can at the end of the day do what is right for Wisconsin families.
Joining me now from Milwaukee is Don Walker, no relation, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's had his eye close on the race from the start to the finish. Don Walker, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie.
I was right about the no relation, right?
That is correct.
But I will say that your newspaper endorsed Scott Walker, and I also want to say that I'm a proud daughter of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, Waukesha County, an epicenter of support for Scott Walker. I think we just wanted to get that out of the way. So, Don, run us through what's happened. We might assume that almost everyone knows why this recall took place, but refresh us a little.
Well, it all began, as it happens, the day after the Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl. It was reported months later that the day after the Super Bowl, Governor Walker convened his cabinet and met and said that he was planning to unveil a plan that, among other things, would severely reduce or curtail the collective bargaining rights for public sector employees. And when that occurred, the response was swift and angry from people who align themselves with organized labor. There were many, many weeks of protests, some of them approaching 70 and 80,000 people showing up at the state capitol to protest Walker's policies. Ultimately, he prevailed in the legislature. The collective bargaining reforms did pass the legislature, were enacted. And many months later, the Democratic Party decided the best course of action was to stage a recall effort rather than wait for the next general election. The Democrats were able, impressively so, to collect well over 900,000 recall signatures. That set in motion the recall effort, culminating in Tuesday's election in favor of Governor Walker.
So Wisconsin actually had a large role to play in creating public sector unions back at the end of the 1950s. This was, as you said, very, very visceral. Here we are now. Tell us how it happened. Democrats were pretty confident of recalling Scott Walker at one point.
Yeah, I think they were. You know, like in sports, you talk about momentum. I think they felt that they had momentum on their side. But I think what really slowed things up, at least from the Democratic point of view, is they had to go through a primary. There was a Dane County executive, former Dane County executive, Kathleen Falk, who was the first to decide to run against Governor Walker in the recall. And she was received a fair amount of union support, but she had to go through a primary because Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett jumped in the race as well. Many people now in retrospect say that slowed the momentum a little bit. They had to decide that election, and then there was a very short turnaround from the primary to yesterday's election, and that may have hurt the Democrats ultimately.
What was turnout like compared to 2010?
Well, turnout was phenomenal, to put it mildly. Our numbers now show that anywhere about 57% of voting age adults voted in Tuesday's election. Those are very impressive numbers. Something in the neighborhood of 2.5 million voters voted yesterday. Governor Walker, in the final numbers now show, he received 53% of the vote versus 46% for Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. The turnout was not quite as high as 2 years ago, but it was very, very close.
Don, talk to me about the money that was spent in this election. Not only was it historic because it was only the third recall in the election, but a phenomenal amount of money was poured in, most of it from outside the state.
That's correct. Ultimately, now we've come up with somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million spent in this recall election from both sides. Governor Walker himself, through a quirk in the recall laws, was allowed to raise unlimited amounts. He himself raised well over $30 million. And for anyone who lived in Wisconsin and bothered to watch their television for the last few weeks, were treated or subjected to an endless series of ads on both sides, but certainly Governor Walker outspent his opponent, Mayor Barrett, something along the lines of 7-1 or 8-1.
And the argument began over public sector unions, but what do you think it really was at the end? How is jobs creation doing in Wisconsin, for example?
Well, that's a great question. I believe it is true to say that the collective bargaining issue sort of went away as we led up to the recall election, and the issue of jobs and job creation rose to the top as a campaign issue, and it became a very contentious one. To make a very long story short, the governor used some new or different, I should say, job data, job information to suggest that during his administration, his first year in office, that he was able to claim creation of more than 30,000 jobs in Wisconsin and used that to say that his policies were working. And the mayor responded by saying, even if I accept those numbers, and he did dispute them, that even if you accept those, that still made Wisconsin rank last in the Midwest in terms of job creation among member states, Minnesota, Illinois, and Michigan, for example.
Don, I just want to take a moment to say that in our introduction, we got wrong the percentage points. In fact, Scott Walker won by about 7 percentage points, which was just about the highest that some of the polls had indicated he had his lead.
That's right. Marquette University's law school, which had probably the only nonpartisan poll out there in the weeks leading up to the election, it turned out they were pretty much spot on. They released a poll last week that showed a 7 percentage point difference, and that's what it ended up being.
Some of the other polls have been intriguing. Tell us about what exit polls say about President Obama's popularity.
Well, that was an interesting sort of side story to Tuesday's election. It appears from our exit polling that we've reviewed that there were people who expressed support in the exit polling for the president as well as for Governor Walker, so there was some overlap there. It's not entirely clear how that will play out in November, but certainly right now there were people who felt strongly for Governor Walker and supported the president, and that would suggest, I would think, that Mitt Romney has a job to do in Wisconsin if he wants to win this state.
Don, I'd like to talk to you as a Wisconsinite now about where this leaves the state and where this leaves people feeling. I was very intrigued by your newspaper's reporting from another Marquette Law School poll that two-thirds of those polled said that they talked politics with the family. More than half said they tried to influence another close friend or relative's vote. And one in three said they'd stop talking about politics with someone because of this, which I must tell you, in my own family, seems the best way to go forward, just to stop talking about it. Where do you think a state that really had unity seemed to be a factor in Wisconsin's history and not so much there today?
Well, that's exactly right. I think, first of all, we're looking at some real recall fatigue here in the state. There's been almost an endless series of elections, and we have another one coming up in August with a Republican primary for U.S. Senate. But absolutely, I think people are tired of talking about it, regardless of their political affiliation. And going forward, I'm not so sure what we're going to see in the legislature. The governor certainly sounded a conciliatory note in his victory speech last night, as did the loser Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, asking everyone to sort of take a step back and let's see if we can work together. But we still have a very, very divided and polarized state. People may be tired of talking about politics now, but in a matter of a few weeks, I suspect that that will rev up again.
Don Walker, would it have made a difference if perhaps a statewide Democrat like Russ Feingold had run for this office in the recall?
Well, he was defeated, as your listeners may know, 2 years ago to a relative unknown, Ron Johnson, in an also very contentious election. If Russ Feingold had decided to jump in this race, I'm not so sure there would have been a difference. The voters sent a pretty strong message 2 years ago that they didn't want Russ Feingold back in the Senate, and Governor Walker surely showed some strong continued support from Republicans this time around. I'm not sure Russ Feingold would have overcome that.
A lot of happy Scott Walker supporters. Don Walker, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker survives a historic recall. And joining me now is Laura Dresser, labor economist, associate director of the Center of Wisconsin Strategy out of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She's an expert on low-wage work and workforce development systems, and she's co-editor of The Gloves Off Economy and co-author of the biennial report, The State of Working Wisconsin. And she joins us from WBEZ in Chicago, our member station. She jumped off a plane right after voting in Wisconsin yesterday. Laura Dresser, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. I drove down.
Good. It is a very, very short flight. Also joining us in Milwaukee is Rick Essenberg. He's a professor of law at Marquette University Law School, which we've been mentioning, and president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And he contributes to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and writes at his own blog, Shark and Shepherd. He's a big Walker supporter. And you must be celebrating today, Rick Essenberg.
Oh yeah. I think for those of us who have supported the governor and his policies, last night was very gratifying.
Well, welcome to On Point. Did you actually go to the Waukesha Expo Center?
No, actually, I was at home doing radio interviews.
Well, that's a very good thing to do. So I think for both of you, what is your biggest takeaway? Laura Dresser, you're a labor economist. Let's start with you, because this is certainly got to be construed as a loss for unions, which really triggered this whole recall fight.
Right. I think that as the reporter was saying earlier, I think the issue really did move away from collective bargaining. It started and was rooted in the collective bargaining and the public sector union rights, but again, moved in a lot of directions since then. And one of the things that I'm really reminded of is, Ohio pursued a very similar collective bargaining law. They had the referendum as a recourse on that, put that to the people, and that law was overturned. The recourse in Wisconsin was the recall. And once you turn it, to an election between two people instead of a referendum on a specific issue, you change the dynamics entirely. And in fact, you switch the issues completely. So I don't think of it particularly as certainly a referendum on public sector unions, though it is, of course, a hard day and a sort of continued evidence of the influence of money and in politics and the decline of unions in their ability to combat that.
But it's got to have public unions in Wisconsin and private unions as well just reeling. This was something that was really seen as make or break by many union members, having collective bargaining rights in public sector jobs.
It is, and I think the unions in Wisconsin, one of the things as we've moved away from the kind of structure of the law of Act 10 on public sector bargaining, I think the focus has turned away. But, if you look at what is happening to public sector unions in Wisconsin, they have half the members they did the year ago. And it is because the structure of the law makes collective bargaining essentially irrelevant and very hard to maintain the infrastructure of. The structure of the law is brutal for unions. And public sector unions are in decline, laying off staff, losing members, losing dues in Wisconsin.
Rick Essenberg, let's turn to you. So many people cheering on the governor, who won by the highest percentage point, 7 points, that Marquette University Law School polls indicated he had that lead. What are people happiest about? Is it ending collective bargaining? Is it jobs creation? That's relatively low. Is it that Governor Walker survived a historic challenge? Do any one of these things, do you think, are any one of these things the primary feeling?
You know, I wrote a magazine article shortly after Governor Walker assumed office, and I said that, you know, the rest of the state was going to meet a person that we've gotten to know here in the city of Milwaukee. He's one of these rare politicians who actually believes that he's elected to office to do something other than assure his own reelection. And he faced a real challenge. The state had a $3.6 billion structural deficit. He didn't want to raise taxes in a state that has taxes that are above average and a below average income. And he didn't want to slash services. So he decided to try to bend the cost curve of government by restricting collective bargaining. Now, whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, it was a bold thing to do. It was a politician taking a problem seriously and making hard choices. And I think one of the reasons that conservatives and Republicans are as supportive of Governor Walker as they are, is that they appreciate his willingness to do that, to take a risk, to try to reform public policy in a way that, you know, he knew was going to result in some opposition, and I think that that the voters of Wisconsin refused to recall a governor over policy differences regarding his reform is, I think, a wonderful thing. I think that, you know, on both sides of the aisle, this will encourage politicians to, you know, to actually try to do something rather than simply follow the polls.
Well, let me push back on you a little bit on that, because you say encourage politicians to do more of this type of thing. But one wonders, this has been a really hard slog for Scott Walker. He has given significant, you say he's bending the cost curve. He has also, we should point out, extended a lot of corporate tax breaks at the top. Is this really the way to go, this kind of my way or the highway approach, which he has certainly been accused of? I mean, even he has said perhaps he would have sold it a little differently in hindsight.
Well, it's hard to I wrote something about this in the Journal Sentinel last week. It's hard to imagine that this could have played out very differently, because as Professor Dresser points out, these reforms were, in a sense, existential for public employee unions, because what Governor Walker was saying is, look, we're going to negotiate with the individual. We're not going to privilege a collective over dissenting public employees and in fact, over the population as a whole. I mean, the legal literature talks about, you know, the ways in which public employee collective bargaining are somewhat problematic in a democracy, because you essentially remove important policy decisions from the electorate to some extent. And so, you know, I think that this was something that enabled him to close this deficit, to not raise taxes. You know, the corporate tax breaks that you talk about were a small, small fraction of that $3.6 billion, and yet not have significant reductions in public services. I think that's pretty good. That's pretty good for government work.
Laura Dresser, what do you think this is going to say to other governors who've been considering reductions in collective bargaining rights for public sector unions, such as in Ohio?
Well, I think, you know, the evidence, again, if you have a state like Ohio, that makes it clear that if you've got a referendum, you probably don't want to do this. But if your only choice is recall, then, you know, maybe you can pursue the policy. But I think it's also clear, you know, you set up a fight and you set up a focus on that fight. And with a kind of my way or the highway approach, which I think he had, and a kind of vast reach on the policy, going back to the history of public sector bargaining starting in Wisconsin and sort of then beginning to end here. You know, that felt aggressive and overreach and alienated a lot of people. It didn't alienate more than 50%, but it did, you know, create a lot of dynamics in the state that I think have detracted from what was supposed to be his agenda on jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly would be a historic chapter, beginning and ending in the state, as indeed the story of collective bargaining rights for public sector unions seems to be doing. Let's go to some callers here now. Mary is calling from Smyrna, Tennessee. Mary, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I just came from Madison, Wisconsin. I live there part of the time and then Tampa, Florida, the other part of the time. My sense of the battle is much different than some of the callers you've had. Mr. Walker, to begin with, sounded like there was a fairly even interspersal of ads between the Walker ads paid for by the Koch brothers and the Karl Rove, you know, the organizations and corporate donors. And Tom Barrett ads, there were almost no Tom Barrett ads seen.
So are you saying, Mary, that you think that advertising works, that money paid for by out-of-state contributors works?
This is a referendum on Citizens United and how it can destroy the democratic process. That's the point of what most of us who have learned, who wanted to recall Scott Walker.
And why did you come there all the way from Smyrna, Tennessee? I mean, you're talking about out-of-state contributors.
I'm going through Smyrna, Tennessee. I live in Wisconsin, and I also live in Tampa, Florida. So we're on our way back to Florida.
And you came back just to participate.
Yeah, we came back to participate. And what the problem with Walker's ads paid for by the Koch brothers and their ilk is that they're really trying to wipe out the democratic process. They want to wipe out the unions because the unions are the boots on the ground that help fight for the Democrats. The Republicans would like to wipe out the democratic voice.
Okay. Thank you for making that point. I would like to turn to Rick Essenberg. I mean, Rick, when you hear someone like Mary, and you're going to be hearing a lot of it, this money was absolutely astronomical. And there's got to be takeaways from that for the Republicans who spent, what, you got $9 million from the Republican Governors Association, a very effective campaigner. Scott Walker raised over $30 million himself in public appearances in places like Florida. How much do you think money made the difference here?
Well, first of all, it simply is not true that there were almost no Tom Barrett ads. I mean, Tom Barrett had a substantial
ad game going on. But there were a lot less.
There were fewer, but I think to say that that the Democrats were unable to get their message out is just wrong. As an empirical matter, this has been an 18-month process in Wisconsin. It wasn't just the money that was spent in the recall election in the past couple of months. There was a great deal of money that has been spent on both sides. From out-of-state donors, beginning in February of last year, we had a recall. We had a Supreme Court race that was turned into a referendum on Governor Walker. We had summer recalls. This is not something that simply has played out over the past couple of months. I'm very skeptical about that 8-to-1 number because it doesn't really reflect, at least what I was able to see. A lot of money was spent, and there are people that are disturbed by that. But we spend a lot more money selling, beer and cheese in this country than we do engaging in political expression. I think President Obama has shown, and we even saw in Wisconsin earlier during the summer recalls that the Democrats can raise money if they want to do it. I think that part of the problem here is that the National Democrats saw that they weren't going to win this thing, and they pulled back. President Obama wouldn't mm-hmm. come here. One of the unreported stories so far, but you hear it if you talk to your Democratic and liberal friends, is the people on the ground here in Wisconsin who supported the recall are not very happy with the National Party and national organized democratic interests because they basically abandoned the effort.
Okay, thank you, Rick. Let's just get another perspective on that wider look here. And joining us from Washington is David Lauder, and he's Washington Bureau Chief at the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune. And he's writing a lot on this recall election and just what it might mean nationally come November. David Lauder, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jackie.
So we were just talking about the money being spent here and the national implications that we'll have with Rick Essenberg's talking about, you know, we spend more on beer and cheese, but both parties really have to be taking a very serious look at what money has achieved in Wisconsin. Sentiment, too, but sentiment fueled by a lot of bucks.
There's no doubt there was a huge amount of money spent, and the Republicans clearly had a big financial advantage over the other side, although I think it's really, when you add up all the money from the outside groups, it's closer to 3-1 than the 7-1 or 8-1 that people are throwing around. I also think it's an overrated factor, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
When I was up in Wisconsin recently, spent a week going around talking to voters, and as the polls also indicated, there were almost no undecided voters in the state. The exit polls indicated that most people had made up their minds long before the campaign began. So I think a lot of this money, frankly, went to line the pockets of the political consultants and fatten the profits of TV stations.
Because by May, a lot of people were in fact decided. There was such a tiny pool of undecided people that all that money was chasing.
That's right. So there was a lot of money chasing very few people. The portion of the money that probably made a difference was the money that went into the get-out-the-vote efforts on both sides. And what the Republicans proved, and this is problematic for the Democrats, is that they could turn out their side really effectively. A lot of Democrats said, if the turnout is high, we'll win. Well, the turnout was high, and they lost.
So, in fact, the Republicans were able to get out the vote with a very, very well-organized grassroots effort for the first time, really, in this kind of election.
They had a very well-organized grassroots effort, and for all that the Democrats had a lot of sentiment and fervor on their side, there was a lot of energy and fervor on the Republican side, too. If you look at the returns, Tom Barrett, the Democrat, actually improved on his 2010 vote by around almost 200,000 votes in the two big Democratic counties surrounding Madison and Milwaukee, the two big Democratic strongholds in the state. But Governor Walker improved on his 2010 vote by around 400,000 votes everywhere else in the state. So the turnout machines went head-to-head, and the Republicans did better.
And Rick Essenberg, Scott Walker also got a tremendous amount of votes in the May primary, even though he was uncontested. That was also a signal of his support, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost unprecedented. I mean, he almost beat the entire Democratic field when he had no serious opposition. I mean, I think that's an excellent point. What we've seen here is, an unbelievable ability, really, on the part of both parties. I mean, the Democrats did a fantastic job turning out their vote. We wouldn't have expected that the Republicans would be able to match them, but they did.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Wisconsin, Governor Walker, and the sharp partisan battle, the Wisconsin Civil War. And last night, following the results of the recall, one supporter of Mayor Tom Barrett, the Democratic challenger, was moved to tears and said the impact of the recall would ring out beyond Wisconsin's borders.
We're not just disappointed. This is the end of democracy. We just got outspent $34 million to $4 million. This was the biggest election in America.
Joining the conversation today is Laura Dresser. She's labor economist and associate director of the Center of Wisconsin Strategy. And in Milwaukee, we have with us Rick Essenberg. He's president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and professor of law at Marquette University. And in Washington, we're joined by David Lauder. He's the Washington Bureau Chief at the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune. Let's go to our callers. We've got a lot of them. Rod, you're calling us from Nashville, Tennessee. Does that mean that that's where you vote as well? And we seem to have lost Rod. So we will go to Steve, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Jackie, I have three very quick points.
Three, all right. Quick.
Quick. Number one, I didn't hear Democratic voters decrying the destruction of democracy when President Obama spent $800 million on his campaign, outspending McCain Palin 2-1. Second thing is, I'm not sure how much money really influences these elections. I mean, Wisconsin voters are a pretty literate bunch of people there, and people like Professor Dresser and other academics have a pretty big megaphone to influence even without money. And the third thing is, I don't think too much should be read into this election, because I think sensible middle ground voters are very reticent to throw out a governor, or for that matter, a president, unless he or she has done something really egregious.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve, for making those points. Laura Dresser, since you were called up by name, let me ask you, do you feel like you've got a big megaphone here?
Well, I feel like this year has been a year where everybody's gotten a bit more megaphone than they ever had before. Certainly, there's a lot of people talking about things, you know, and thinking about political issues in ways. And I think that is a gain to the state. We have thought harder about our politics and what to do for the state of Wisconsin. We have become very divided in that, but we're all thinking and talking about it, and that's probably worth something. You know, it is. I do think it's a little too facile to say that money doesn't matter at all. Outspending 3-1, 7-1, you know, the net effect of that does sort of dampen the middle. I think it's people who are, you know, it's very hard to be undecided in Wisconsin. But once a lot of junk is thrown on both candidates, it's very easy to stay undecided. And I think that going forward, we will always have, or we will increasingly have, this issue of corporate and outside interest in state and local and in national politics. And we don't have a good answer on how we assure that people have a voice equal, or a megaphone equal to that that money buys.
Let's go to a caller here. Linda is calling from Florence, South Carolina. Welcome to On Point, Linda.
Hi, Jackie. I was calling because I contributed money to the Scott Walker campaign, and I'm one of those out-of-state contributors, but I sent two contributions of $50 each. I'm a professor in South Carolina, and I've watched our governor struggle with trying to keep the state from going bankrupt, Nikki Haley. And I object to the characterization of out-of-state contributions as some kind of big corporate conspiracy and overwhelming monetary power. There are a lot of small folks like myself who just support freedom and individualism, and who sent money out of our small salary to support Scott Walker and what he's doing.
Thank you so much for calling in and making that point, Linda. David Lauder, let me ask you about this in national terms. You just heard a caller who sent in two $50 contributions from South Carolina. This has been called the second most important race in the country this year. Do you see it having national implications, or is the press making too much of that?
I think it does have some national implications. I think one of the clearest implications is that the electorate, at least in Wisconsin, at least last night, still looks an awful lot like 2010. You have a lot of anxious, perhaps angry voters who are not convinced that the Democrats are looking out for their interests. And that is going to continue to be a problem for President Obama, not just in potentially Wisconsin, but maybe even more so in states that are closer to the margin, like Ohio and Iowa. I think it's also true that one of the lessons that you can take away from Wisconsin is that partisanship, although it's really divisive and sometimes nasty, also gets people engaged, like your caller, Linda. Voter turnout is up. It was up in Wisconsin. It was up in the last election. It was up in the election before that. And that's because people are battling over issues that they care passionately about. So to the extent that we think that voter turnout, high voter turnout, is good for democracy, this kind of passionate partisan battle that we're seeing is not entirely a bad thing.
You know, it was interesting, the same exit polls, and we've talked about the polls, at least at Marquette, Rick, being, you know, fairly accurate, that you're seeing in these exit polls support for President Obama, even though people voted in Scott Walker. And there were indeed the presence of Walker Obama voters, which might seem like a contradiction. What are we to make of that? Does that mean that some of these people didn't like the recall, do like President Obama, who won by 14 points in 2008 and is still perceived to be pretty far ahead of Mitt Romney in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there were definitely some votes for Walker that were sort of bound up with the notion that, you know, we shouldn't recall governors over policy differences. I think you have to be a little bit careful with how you treat those exit poll numbers, because most of the exit polls showed the race as being a lot closer than it in fact was. And so it also may be the case that the divide between Governor Romney and President Obama is closer than the exit polls suggest. And that wouldn't be surprising because, you know, Wisconsin has historically been a purple state. It's sharply divided. You know, I've had conversations with a lot of Democrats who tend to believe that in Wisconsin 2008 was a bit of an outlier, and that they expect the presidential election in 2012, and have always expected the presidential election in 2012 to be somewhat closer here than it was 4 years ago.
David is calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, David.
Hi, Jackie. I have a question on the substance of what happened in Wisconsin in terms of repealing collective bargaining. As I understand it, just about every state in the nation has collective bargaining, and just about every state in the nation has to balance its budget. And every state in the nation has done so by having to lay off employees when there's not insufficient tax revenue coming in. Why did Wisconsin find it necessary to do that? In Massachusetts, for instance, thousands of teachers have been laid off, thousands of police and public works employees and firefighters have been laid off. Without ending collective bargaining, what was it about Wisconsin that required them to have to lay off? And we had pretty strong collective bargaining, but...
Rick Essenberg, maybe you want to take that and tell us, how is Wisconsin doing on job creation? I mean, part of the argument here, wasn't it, we have to balance the budget repair bill, create new jobs. Scott Walker had promised 250,000 jobs at the end of 4 years. Is ending collective bargaining helping him reach that goal?
Well, I think with respect to the caller's question, I think that the question sort of suggests the answer. Governor Walker didn't want to have thousands of public employees laid off. With respect to the jobs issue, I'm not sure that there's been enough time to tell what effect these policies will have on employment numbers. And one of the astonishing things we saw here in Wisconsin in this very passionate debate was, you know, people started to talk about all sorts of different economic metrics, you know, the household survey, the establishment survey, the QCEW. And you know, I think the bottom line is, it was summed up pretty well by an economist for the Department of Revenue. He said, you can't look at one economic metric, which is what the Democrats wanted to do. They wanted to look at this establishment survey. He said, I look at about six different things to see how the state is doing. And five of them seem to show that the state's doing pretty well. There seems to be some type of anomaly with this establishment survey. I don't know what it was. They re-benchmarked it. And so, you know, two things about that. I mean, first of all, I don't necessarily buy the narrative that Governor Walker's policies have been an economic failure. But I think it was rather incredible that the public became that engaged in, you know, discussing these granular economic issues. I think that's a good thing.
Well, the public, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. Let's take a call from Rod, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. We lost you a moment or two ago, Rod. Thanks for calling back to On Point.
Thank you, Jackie. Lovely and vibrant discussion as usual. Great program. I am a minority. I am a public safety service employee, and I am a union member. I do support what Scott Walker is asserting. I do not believe that our democracy has fallen into ruin because of all the money that is being entered in on the debates. I think it's more lively than any time before, and I'm excited about this year. The focus of this is still our economy and our jobs. And your guest would like to go ahead and continue to comment on that. I would take my answer off the air because it is.
Okay.
Our focus is about jobs and the economy.
Thanks for hanging in there and calling back, Rod. We've had a lot of people calling in, pro and con on unions. Here's John C., who's commented on a website, "I'm surprised. I expected the unions to nail this one down, considering the media coverage coming out of Wisconsin. Not sure if it's the right thing, but I hope it works out." What do you think, Laura? Are unions today scratching their heads and wondering what to do next?
Well, I'm sure unions are today scratching their heads a bit and wondering what to do next. I'm sure also that there are, you know, clear sets of things to do. And I think, you know, that the previous caller is right. It is about jobs, though, in fact, you know, governors, I think it's a little facile to pretend that governors actually control their job base. Basically, states follow the national economy. And if we're in a national recovery.
Or presidents, perhaps.
Yes. Well, even presidents. There's a stronger case there, but governors, you know. Anyway, so the state will follow the national economy. In fact, the state kind of decoupled from the national economy on most of those six indicators. We're slower than the national recovery. But I think, in fact, what a governor has to do is build for the long term. What we all have to do is build for an economy for the long term. That's about education and internet and rail and transportation. It's about a lot of things that actually require a real public sector commitment, a real tax base.
Well, let's get a couple more workers in if we can. Randy is calling from Burnside, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point, Randy.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a union iron worker, and all this is class warfare. It's the billionaires against the millionaires. The Republicans want to see the unions gone. They want everybody to work a minimum wage. Walmart's a perfect example. No insurance, had to get on state aid for insurance. I don't think the Founding Fathers ever foresee this coming down the pike.
Well, Randy, what do you say to the caller who's also a union worker, a firefighter from Tennessee, who's happy with this decision? He's a union worker as well.
Tennessee's a right-to-work state. Right-to-work state does not help nobody. The contractors are in business to make money, and they're cutting the people that we need most, education, protection, and firefighters.
All right. Thank you very much for making that point. And let's take one more call. Audrey is calling, also from Nashville. Audrey, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. You know, I began this conversation to say one thing, and I'm ending up with another.
Like the recall.
Nashville is a right-to-work state. However, that firefighter has a union, where the rest of us do not have a union anymore. There is no more collective bargaining here. So when the decision to make a pay raise for me comes, supposedly it's individual. However, what's happening is that they're taking out people like myself who are 30 years and replacing us with brand new individuals who don't have a clue. But yet, our same representatives, our governors, our senators, our everyone, they get a pay raise collectively. They have collective bargaining. So it's okay for them, but it's not okay for the rest of us.
All right.
And in terms of all this money that they raise for races, why don't you just take that money and funnel it off to the debt instead? We might be in a better place than having to watch these ridiculous ads.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Audrey. David Lauder, I just want to ask before we end, lots of passion out there. Is this going to, rather than fatigue, maybe there'll be fatigue in Wisconsin, but how much does this energize people nationally for November?
Well, I don't know whether this particular election energizes people, but I think people are energized in general. I think, you know, we're in an era of high turnout, high energy elections, and close ones too. And I think we're going to see more of that. I think in Wisconsin, we'll see, you know, that there are actually a substantial number of voters who side both with Scott Walker and President Obama.
despite the fact that partisans on both sides think that that's impossible. And I think we're going to see a series of close, hard-fought, very passionate elections where a lot of people are going to turn out to vote because they care about the result.
Well, we want to thank everyone very much for being with us today. David Lauder, Washington Bureau Chief at the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune. Rick Essenberg was with us from Milwaukee. He's President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He writes a blog called Shark and Shepherd, and he's also a Milwaukeean. And joining the conversation, too, was Laura Dresser, Wisconsinite, labor economist, associate director of the Center for Wisconsin Strategy. She joined us from Chicago. And thank you all. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and you are listening to On Point.